Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
10 to 15 miles per hour.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, I'm going to be joined by the author of a brand new book, How to Think About Information. Our guest will be Dan Schiller, professor here at the University of Illinois and one of the world's leading authorities on information and telecommunication policy. So join me first today, but first let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
From the 2007 National Conference for Media Reform in Memphis, Tennessee, this is Media Minutes, your look at news at the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
Scholars from all over North America converged on Memphis Thursday for a pre-conference to discuss how the Academy can most effectively participate in the formulation of media policy. The conference, co-sponsored by the Social Science Research Council and Free Press, was designed to get scholars thinking more about how to counter the avalanche of industry-sponsored pseudo-research, which currently dominates most policy debates. Free Press co-founder and president Robert McChesney says we're at a critical juncture in the formulation of media policy, with decisions being made that could be felt for generations to come.
We're in a period in which the traditional system is not working anymore, and in which we're in a period in which a new system is being created. And we have a chance during a critical juncture to actually affect what sort of system in a much greater way than you do during a period of normalcy or stability.
How can scholars best intervene in this juncture to make our media environment more democratic? Social Science Research Council President Craig Calhoun says the first step is to transform the knowledge production process, making it more responsive to today's political realities.
It is a tragedy when academia cuts itself off from active participation in the public sphere. It is a tragedy when academic scholarship is evaluated solely on publication in refereed articles where things will be read by six other specialists if you're lucky.
Calhoun also believes there should be a strategic focus on directly challenging the dominant paradigm of policymaking today.
We need to contest the privatization of everything. I don't mean to suggest that there are not activities that are crucially and importantly privately organized, but that the presumption of privatization as the way things should work is a problematic one.
FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein also attended the pre-conference. He believes firmly putting the public interest back into media policymaking will be a daunting task, but one that's become a lot easier since media issues first burst into the public consciousness just a few years ago.
We need to work together now to develop a positive agenda going forward and not just play defense. If you think about it, you know, after several years here of uncoordinated efforts without this kind of collaboration, without really working together as closely as we could and thinking about it, we've done incredible. We've awakened the sleeping giant, the American people, and they are galvanized now into what you really could describe as a mass movement, a new civil rights movement, which is critical in this modern day.
More than 3,000 people are expected to attend the National Conference for Media Reform itself. One of them is independent journalist Sarah Olson. She helped break the story of Army Lieutenant Aaron Watada, the first commissioned officer to refuse deployment to Iraq. Lieutenant Watada currently faces court-martial on several charges, at least one of which relates to critical statements he made about the military to Olson and other journalists. Olson subsequently published reports in print and on the radio quoting Watada directly. These articles are in the public domain, yet the Army has subpoenaed Olson to testify against Watada in his military trial.
To date, she has refused.
I think that when you subpoena journalists, when you haul them in front of a military court in this way, it erodes the very necessary separation between government and press. I think journalists become seen then as the investigative arm or the eyes and ears of the government.
Undermining even the perceived objectivity of journalists can have nothing but a chilling effect on critical speech involving public matters. The military's prosecution also directly challenges the freedom of speech of soldiers themselves, even when they speak out of uniform as regular American citizens, like Watada did.
It will have precedents and ramifications for the legality of political speech and particularly dissent among the military. The case law that they're looking at now dates back to early Vietnam. And so this has the potential to be with us, both positive or negative, for decades.
Olson's received a lot of moral support from journalists around the country, but Lieutenant Watada's court-martial is scheduled for early February. And until then, both of their fates hang in the balance.
Should I decide not to testify, I'm facing a felony contempt of court charge and 6 months in prison and or a fine of up to $500.
To learn more about this case and its implications for independent journalism in a time of war, visit www.freepresswg.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today is our guest. We've got the author of a brand new book, How to Think About Information, published by the University of Illinois Press. Our guest is Dan Schiller, professor in the Institute of Communications Research and the Graduate School of Library and Information Science here at the University of Illinois, a frequent guest on Media Matters, and for my money, and I think the money of those who follow the area, one of the leading experts, if not the leading expert in the world in information and telecommunication policy. Welcome back to Media Matters, Dan.
Thanks, Bob. It's good to be here.
Well, it's great to be here. Now, first of all, you've got a brand new book out, How to Think About Information. How should we think about information?
Critically. And with sustained attention to the shaping forces of information as a social product and social phenomenon rather than as a technical issue purely or a matter that is only significant from the point of view of engineering or some kind of technical solution.
What is information? And, you know, you go in the book, you discuss the components of it. You know, what is information and why do you use this term? Why not use communication or culture or some other term? Why do you gravitate to the term information? What power does this term have that you want to convey?
I think of information as a more encompassing term than either of the other two that you just use, culture or communication. I don't want to make too big a deal about this in the sense that I think we could be talking about very, very overlapping concepts using either of those other terms. The reason for using information as opposed to culture, for example, is that I want to include in the concept various kinds of biological and biotechnological phenomena as well as more familiar genres of media industry or culture industry, such as television or the music industry or publishing. And so information covers uneasily, but covers both the cultural range and communications and, in addition, that quotient of factual, scientific, biological production that would otherwise perhaps be avoided.
Now, this book has a number of arguments, excuse me, in it that I want to talk about. In How to Think About Information. What does the genesis of this book? I mean, this is, how did you come to think about writing it? What went into it?
This is a book that comes out of about 20 years or so of thinking about the issues that have gone into it. I wrote an essay about 20 years ago called How to Think About Information, which is included in this book.
In fact, and it's chapter one, isn't
it? It's chapter one. Yeah, and so I've been working, you could say, consistently, I hope not erroneously, but consistently for a long time on the themes that are covered in the book. I wanted to give it a more extended range and a more systematic treatment than I could do in that particular article. And so I've been working up a variety of chapters over the intervening years, and this seemed like the suitable basis for putting them together and then rewriting the whole in light of the need for a book as opposed to a chapter.
Well, you cover a lot of ground in the book, Dan Schiller, and I really want to spend the next much of the next hour talking about some of the themes you talk on, because they really go directly to the key issues of our times in the coming years, both nationally in the United States and globally. Let's start with the concept which really girds the entire book, which is commodification. And what does that term mean, and why is it important for understanding information in our society?
I think commodification is at the core of the processes that we're seeing all around us unfolding in very diverse and even seemingly disparate spheres of activity. Commodification, in my usage of it, refers to the development of the fundamental processes of capitalism around information. I need to back up a little bit in order to make this argument. The fundamental processes of capitalism are in motion always. They are never still. They can't be still because the process of capitalist development is ongoing. It may go through phases of very, very active and rapid development, and then phases of slowdown or we call depression or recession. But the overall process is always dynamic, always occurring. And what that process looks like from my perspective, as I'm trying to underline it in this book, is one of uneven movement to claim areas of production that have previously not been part of capitalist development. So to put this in a very, very kind of basic and even crude way,
yeah, please do.
We start with developments of capitalism in agriculture. And there is the emergence of wage labor, that is to say, people who are working for other people who put them to work on plows and eventually tractors and other sorts of implements that are used in whatever historical state agriculture develops. And that then generates a profit for the owners of the land, the owners of the implements of production, and the people who are doing the work are wage laborers.
And that's the process of commodification?
That process by which people are brought into the wage relationship is the process of commodification.
And that means they're producing something that's sold on the market?
It means that they're producing something that's sold on the market, but that even more basically, they're producing it as the employees of somebody else. And that is the core process, which has the virtue, as I see it anyway, of returning us to labor and production as the center of the process of capitalist development.
And how does commodification apply to information? Because is there labor with producing information? I mean, isn't information like just out there?
Well, in a word, no. Information has to be assimilated by social mechanisms some way or another in order to play any kind of part in the processes of the political economy. And so it may be that the process of assimilating it is relatively straightforward, you just look around and say it's raining out and then put that onto the Weather Channel. But the process of putting that onto the Weather Channel is a social process that involves us in political economic relationships where there are people working on camera, people working off camera, people writing scripts, people putting together the kind of background for the production that occurs so that they have a particular map in the background that has to be designed. There's a whole chain of labor relationships which to a greater or lesser extent unfolds as wage labor, and it is to the unfolding as wage labor that I'm trying to draw attention in the informational realm. So just to continue that thought for a moment, the early developments of wage relationships and of capitalism in information are not, strictly speaking, only evident today. They go back a long way. Elizabethan drama can be understood in part, as the scholar Laura Taub has written, in the context of unfolding relationships of capitalist production. It has a claim, actually, the early drama in England, Elizabethan times, the 1600s, to being, if not the first, then one of the very first capitalist culture industries.
Mm-hmm.
There is a kind of occasional and intermittent development of areas of production that I would include under information all the way from the 1600s forward. But it doesn't begin to attain a generalized impulse until a much later period, probably the 20th century and arguably the post-Second World War period. And so what we're seeing, and this is an argument that I make at some length in the book, is an acceleration of the commodification process around information, very, very disparate streams of information, somewhere around the end of the Second World War for reasons that we can get into.
Absolutely. Our guest today on Media Matters is Dan Schiller, professor here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in both communication and library science. Dan is the author of the brand new book, How to Think About Information, just published this year, 2007, by University of Illinois Press. This is a pre-recorded show. We taped it before going on the air, so please don't call in today. Sit back, relax, let us do the talking. You talk about, Dan, in the book, the commodification of information, the accelerated commodification of information, which means being taken over to be produced for profit, I guess.
Yes.
Using labor is another way to put it.
Yeah.
Is information different from other entities in the economy? Or is it really just the same? I mean, is the commodification going on there the same as hamburgers or steel? Or is there something that distinguishes it that you want to talk about?
I think that information, of course, has its own uniqueness as an area, and the effects certainly of commodification are very specific when we're talking about the informational realm because they bear urgently on the nature of democratic self-organization.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense of the mechanisms of commodification, however, there is not such a great difference between information and other areas in my way of handling it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my effort has been to try to see information commodification as consistent with the long-standing processes of capitalist development across other areas of social production,
mm-hmm.
manufacturing, agriculture, and so forth. My argument is that we are in a period where one of the distinctive features, perhaps the distinctive feature of capitalism, is its focus on the informational realm. And that is one area of specificity. So that's a way of saying that, yes, there's a mark of uniqueness around information because it's the current hub of dynamism for the political economy. In terms of the effects, there is also, as I just suggested, a fundamental uniqueness that's of great importance, which is that when you subject information to wage and market relationships, you're talking about enclosure of information, you're talking about putting profit and loss criteria onto information production and use, and that has very grave implications for democratic forms of politics.
Our guest, Dan Schiller, author of the brand new book, How to Think About Information, published by University of Illinois Press this year, 2007. Dan, I mean, so far listeners might be thinking we're dealing with a fairly abstract and theoretical and historical book. In fact, quite the opposite. The book touches on a number of very pressing political and intellectual issues of our times. And let's go through some of those right now. One of the issues you raise in the book when you talk about the commodification of information is the emergence of biotechnology as an aspect of information, which was frankly something I hadn't really thought in those terms. Why is biotechnology information? What role does it play, or do you see it coming to play in our economy?
I think that there is still a need for further work on the area of biotechnology as an information industry. But there has been considerable work already on this. And in fact, it's relatively non-controversial amongst people who follow this area specifically to treat the development of biotechnology as predicated on an understanding of biotechnology as an information area. So the idea that the processes of cell formation or of the development of organisms occur as information processing kinds of developments, this is very, very frequent and perhaps even essential to the development of gene splicing and other forms of recombinant DNA and biotechnology as a general matter. The idea that these are informational processes has been coded very deeply into the consciousness of the scientists who are doing the work.
Let me interrupt you if I can for a second, Dan. It's an information, it's coded as information. What about the automobile industry or the fast food industry? Don't they all require fairly sophisticated information? I mean, codes and plans and blueprints to make a McDonald's hamburger?
Absolutely. And so the
idea. Why aren't they information industries?
Well, they're not information industries in their entirety. There is no doubt an informational component of those industries. And I try to point out in the book places where that component has manifested itself, been important. So you're quite right. You can't have a modern automobile production system without all kinds of extensive informational inputs, and those have become areas of galvanic technological change over the past 30, 40 years. For example, to try to get a little less abstract, the fact that you have a global division of labor within any one automobile company, mm-hmm. so that you have components made in one place, you have assembly in another place, and you might find that the final automobile is reflecting the processes of labor that are occurring around 10 different locations around the world. Well, to coordinate those locations requires extensive informational transfers of different kinds. And those have been one of the fulcrums of development over the past 20, 30 years in the automobile industry. So your question's absolutely on the mark. Biotechnology is perhaps a more thoroughgoing area of information processing where almost the whole industry is organized around an informational component. And it's in that sense that I would claim it more frontally as an information industry.
Now, Dan Schiller, you're arguing in How to Think About Information that information as a sector of the economy has grown dramatically.
Yes.
So you know, we call it the information age. We need to understand as maybe the defining sector in our economy today, not only in the United States, but globally. At the same time, and what I think is very interesting about your argument that you develop in the book is that you argue, as I understand it, that say 35, 40 years ago, in that period roughly, the people who run the United States, the policymakers, the government officials, leading business figures, actually consciously said, we've got to turn to develop the information sector in sort of a visionary manner, in one sense, that this is where the future is going to be for the economy, but also as a way to battle stagnation, as a way to generate growth in the economy. This was a very interesting argument. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
And then tell us how successful they've been.
Right. Well, that's a key point. The question of how elites identify new areas to develop and to make profitable is a recurrent one. It's not something that presents itself for the first and only time around information.
I mean, doesn't the market work magically that profit opportunities show up and smart capitalists devote their capital to, you know, getting profits there?
At a certain point, it's more or less on automatic pilot, but it doesn't just go on automatic pilot from the beginning. Mm-hmm. At the outset and for some varying period of time thereafter, there have to be conscious decisions made about where to put investment, where to try to hire people, how to develop for-profit different areas of economic activity. And this began to happen, I argue, around information in a fairly concerted way around the 1970s. It's not to say there
there weren't earlier anticipations, that it didn't take off more extensively afterward. But sometime around 1970, there began to be very systematic deliberation about how to develop this sector of the economy more intensively on a profit basis. And the people who were thinking about this were, as you say, government and business leaders, and they summoned think tanks and specialized policy-making bodies to try to do some of the spade work, to try to get an idea, well, how could this be done? Is it likely to pay off? What's the range of activity that could be encompassed by it? And there were a variety of specialized studies undertaken by such groups as the Committee for Economic Development and think tanks of different kinds, the conference board, producing studies that centered at that time mostly on information and communications technology, but as the undergirding technical infrastructure for the kinds of
high-tech sector.
The high-tech sector, and the process of saying this is where the higher levels of profit will lie. The reason that they began to need to try to identify these prospective high-flying areas of activity was because the existing ones were beset by an increasingly significant economic competitive crisis.
The traditional manufacturing industries?
Traditional manufacturing industries, as you know, and even more generally than that, were beset by competition from rival pools of capital in Japan and in Western Europe, and shortly thereafter in other areas of the globe, Korea, Taiwan, and so forth, where the result was to produce a lower level of profitability in these areas of production. And we're seeing the full effect of that, of course, today.
Where, so this is a good thing, then, that our leaders wanted to save our economy from the ravages of competition and give us a new area to expand into.
At the level of the effects, you have to ask who has been the primary recipient of benefits produced by this strategy. And I think that from the point of view of the tens of thousands of auto workers who are now having to take buyouts, the question of whether the benefits have flown to them is pretty obvious. They have not. Mm-hmm. And auto workers, of course, have historically, since the famous struggles in the 1930s, been areas of privilege in the overall U.S. political economy within the working people's sector. There are, of course, people who are far worse off than the auto workers. So I think that the question you're pointing us toward here is a profound one. And the question is, who has obtained the benefits of informationalized capitalism? Those benefits have not flowed to American working people or to what are euphemistically called the American middle class. Middle class here, meaning people that work for a living, and we would want to include under this term not just middle class people, but people who are unable to find jobs, people who are put into casualized jobs, people who don't have the ability to have insurance, people who are in hard times. So the middle class term is really a euphemism that I find less useful.
Well, let me put this another way if I can, Dan Schiller. I mean, one of the arguments you make in the book is that policy elites in the 1970s turned to the information sector as an alternative to the declining sector, also as a cure to sort of what emerged in the 1970s was very slow growth rates in the economy, rising unemployment, tremendous instability in the United States economy, and fears about its prospects for the future. And then information was seen as a way to generate tremendous amounts of growth, and theoretically, at least, in economic theory, that would mean rising incomes and the rising tide for all of us. So even if it wasn't distributed especially evenly or equitably, some benefits would accrue to everyone if you have a rapidly growing economy. Has it at least delivered at that end? With unintentional benefits for poor people, but at least it raised the tide high enough for everyone else.
I don't see it that way, honestly. I mean, I think in the United States context, and even the United States is still a very wealthy country and is one of the most favored places to live in the world. Even with that admission, the benefits of informationalization have been very, very channeled to elites. And so, I mean, I'm not the one that studies the development of inequality in the United States, but study after study, most recently I've seen a study by Paul Krugman, the New York Times economics columnist, that indicates that inequality in the United States is gravely developing for 30, 35 years.
Roughly the same time span.
Roughly the same span in which informationalized capitalism has been generalized. And I don't think that this is simply haphazard. These two things are intimately interconnected.
Our guest today, Dan Schiller, professor of information and communication here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Dan Schiller is also the author of the brand new book, How to Think About Information, which has been published by the University of Illinois Press this year, 2007. Dan, you go through some of the political issues surrounding this in the book. It's, I think, really a lot of the book deals with this, and it's very interesting material. I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the historical material in the book, recent history, not 16th century stuff, because it really sets up the current political fights, I think, pretty well. One issue you raise in here that we've spoken about on the air before, but it's something that few Americans are really very familiar with, is something called the New International Information Order, NIIO, also sometimes called the New World Information and Communication Order, NWICO, both long sets of initials, but very important, aren't they? Tell us what the NIIO refers to, why that's something we should know about.
In the post-war period, there was a fundamental process of political economic change occurring throughout the large parts of the world that had previously been colonized by European powers and secondarily by Japan. And there was the process of decolonization occurring throughout Africa, much of Asia, throughout the 1950s and into the 60s. As part of that process, which also came to affect the Latin American countries who were formally independent but continued to be under the shadow of U.S. political economic power, as part of that process of attaining independence and an effort at national self-determination, as it used to be called, the leaders of many of these so-called, at that time, third world countries, now we call them the global south, the less developed countries of the world in Africa and Asia and Latin America, targeted the imbalances in the international economy that they saw as contributing to a continuation of a gravely weakened status, an inability to claim the autonomous development that they insisted on as a condition of their own continuing history. And this initially took the form of a claim for a new international economic order in the 1950s and 60s. And then shortly thereafter, and again, the chronology is not accidental. It's part of the growth of an informationalized capitalism that they could come to see this. There began to be a focus out of the new international information or new international economic order movement on information and communications. So there began to be a concern that was voiced by different leaders in the global south on, for example, the fact that the networks that bound them into the global economy were skewed. So if you wanted to send a message from Argentina to Brazil, you had to go by way of London. Mm-hmm. Which is, from an engineering perspective, given the technology of that time, crazy. Mm-hmm. They wanted to figure out how can we create networks that will serve our own political and economic needs as we go forward, our own needs for national development. This did not end with just networks, but also with the flows of cultural commodities, the flows of television, the flows of music and news in particular. Mm-hmm. The images that were circulating on the news system, such as they were of the less developed countries in the 1960s, preponderated in showing the selections and the emphases and, if I can say so, the biases of the Associated Press and of U.S. and Western European, to a lesser extent, news agencies. So they said, we want to see matters and issues of concern to us as a developing country here. We want to know about how to make a better agriculture, how to make the beginnings of industrialization that can work instead of having stories about calamities and earthquakes and disasters of one sort or another, which was what they were confronting.
And what steps did they do to deal with this problem? What was the solution that was being proposed?
Well, any efforts at solution, of course.
And no keeps in suspense. Did they win?
They lost.
Oh, okay. And, few. Well, but, not few. But I mean,
they lost. They lost, however, and in losing set the groundwork in motion, really, you could say, for some of the issues that we're now having to grapple with today around the Internet. Mm-hmm. And we can get to that. But the process put them into collision with the United States in particular, the leadership of the United States. States, and secondarily with Britain, which was coming under the sway of Thatcherism, as the movement for a new international information order was moving toward its crescendo. So, at this point, the U.S. and Britain simply pulled out of UNESCO, which was the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, which was one of the places in which this policy debate was reaching its most acute pitch, was reaching a really significant level of political debate. Mm-hmm. And the debate proved to be unattractive to the U.S. leadership as we moved from the late Carter to early Reagan years. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. simply said, we don't want to play this game anymore. We do not want to listen to these kinds of discussions. We don't want to hear these complaints about the imbalances of global information structures. And so they ceased to be parts of UNESCO. The United States and Britain withdrew from UNESCO and for 19 years ceased to pay into the system. Now, this is presented to the U.S. population as if it's just what we should have done because they're not, these other parts of the world are not playing by the rules that are somehow the right sorts of rules. What the U.S. population was not really able to know was that what the rest of the world was hoping for was a democratization of global information structures that would have been in the interest of the U.S. population as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that you talk about in the book, and it's a phenomenon I think that very few Americans are aware of because in the United States you wouldn't really notice it, which has been what is the privatization of the telephone systems around the world in the last 20 or 25 years, the magnitude of which is really astonishing. Talk a little bit about that process and why that's important for the internet and for the future of information in the world.
The process that I referred to earlier of accelerated commodification of information, which began to happen around 1970, had different manifestations, different dimensions, you could say. One of the critical ones was privatization of telecommunications. And the reason was that telecommunications systems around most of the world had been organized as government ministries. Now, they hadn't been organized especially efficiently. They hadn't been organized in ways that benefited much of the population. There was a great neglect, inadequate provision of service. But the key point I'm trying to draw attention to is that they were not organized principally from the point of view of big business to produce the kinds of services and the kinds of capabilities that in a moment of informationalized capitalism, big business deemed essential. And so there began to be an increasing focus on how to turn this new infrastructure, the telecommunications infrastructure, into a more workable one for big business operations to profit from on a global scale. And issue one, agenda, item one, was to turn that infrastructure into something that was owned and controlled by private business because government ministries were not subjecting it to the processes of profit-making that business wanted to put front and center in the larger context of informationalized capitalism.
And these telephone systems around the world, outside of the United States, there were only a handful of countries 25, 30 years ago that had privately run and regulated phone systems?
Not even that many. Most of the world had government-run telephone systems. And mm-hmm. again, I don't want to imply that these were producing inclusive or universal telephone service or even efficient telephone service. They weren't. But they were also not producing profit for private business.
And where do we stand today? How many of these state-owned monopoly remain in the world today?
State-owned systems, you'd probably have to go just to some of the Arab countries and one or two other countries around the world. We've had a massive transfer of assets over the past generation, possibly an unrivaled transfer of assets. We're talking, in the probably trillions of dollars here as government telephone systems, which draw an incredible amount of economic investment, of course, have been privatized mm-hmm. and turned into areas of profit-making. Now, the point I try to make in an extended way in the book is that far from being a process that has simply benefited business, this process of privatization has has been absolutely riddled with all of the contradictory features of advanced capitalism, so that it has produced crisis as much as anything in the way of a stable order. On the other hand, there have also been, as we know, colossal riches generated for a select few out of the processes of privatization. The investment banks have made out incredibly well. They manage the process of, as they say, floating shares on the open market. The key executives in many of these companies have made out tremendously well. And, of course, in a few cases, they end up doing the perp walk because misdoings and legal.
Yeah, along those lines, you know, one of the arguments in behalf of privatizing these state-run telecommunication telephone companies, which, as you pointed out, were oftentimes maybe the largest company in a country in terms of investment and employment. These are massive enterprises. One of the arguments was that these state-run institutions, not subject to market pressures, were not only bureaucratic, they were highly corrupt, they were riddled with cronyism, did at least the privatization and the emergence of market values and pressures clean out all that corruption.
I would say it replaced it with a different level of corruption, which is perhaps not as pervasive. Who knows? We know that it certainly generated corruption on a fairly significant scale with WorldCom and a bunch of other companies that were associated with the boom of the 90s around telecommunications in the United States. Mm-hmm. There are still significant runoff from those scandals. But I think that the issue is not so much about corruption. The issue is what's been generated here is a key infrastructure for the circulation and development of information products and services for the foreseeable future. And that infrastructure is now beholden not through whatever attenuated or inadequate mechanism of democratic accountability might have existed in the past. It's not beholden just to government agencies, but it's beholden to private capital. Mm-hmm. So what's the way in which we, the citizens, have an ability to influence the decisions that structure information flows, information production over these networks?
So what does that mean for the average person living in India or China or Africa or Alabama, that these telephone companies are now privately run, trying to make profit rather than, outside the United States, state run, for better or for worse, not trying to make profit? How does that show up in the quality of their experience?
Well, one manifestation of it, and I can go into some others that I just want to make sure I get out, is the current dispute over network neutrality. Mm-hmm. That in the current context, I would see the debate over network neutrality in the United States, which is about whether the telephone companies that operate these systems and also the cable companies that operate other broadband or high-speed networks that are being used for internet traffic are going to be able to develop a second source of income in addition to the subscriptions. Well, if you have a privately run telecommunications system, unless there's some form of regulatory oversight, they can decide to charge whomever they want, whatever they want. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're trying to do to get around the idea of network neutrality, is to produce a new income stream through charging any kind of content generator, which might be a small business or it might be a nonprofit or a non-governmental organization trying to get its views out on the air. So from the point of view of someone in Asia or Africa or Alabama, the issue comes down to roost, because those people need to have, just like we all do, access to the most diverse information streams we can get. And when the network operator is a private business without regulatory responsibilities, the ability to get that kind of diverse information flow is reduced. So that's the first issue. Mm-hmm. It's a complex one, I know, but
it's very important. We've talked about it a lot here on Media Matters.
I'm glad you have, actually, because that is a critical issue. But there are others. Who's servicing these systems, these telecommunications networks? And what kinds of a workforce do you have? Do you have an adequate workforce to deal with people's needs in using the systems? Well, how often has any listener that's now hearing our show had the happy experience of calling up the telephone company to get a repair or to order a new service or to have an added listing of one sort or another? And, you go through an automated phone tree. Is that the only way to organize things? So they waste your time so that they can save on the employment costs at their end?
No, I mean, my floor has dents in it from phones hitting the ground waiting on those ridiculous calls.
We don't even think to ask about this. Such is the depth of the informationalized capitalism that is already present with us today. But we need to ask, how can we have a better system of information provision here? And here is an example of it. If you had suitable employment instead of tens of thousands of layoffs on a continuing basis because you have a competitive industry in which each of the network infrastructures is simply trying to pare down costs to the bone, we could have a system that responded to popular need more adequately. So that employment question is, again, critical. There are other areas, the nature of the services that that are offered. Is another area that we need to include. The range of telephone service, the character of, we haven't talked about wireless, but the fact that we've all seemingly accepted a deplorable level of service provision for wireless, where dropped calls and the inability to get through or
I mean,
busy.
That's not built into the technology?
Well, it's built into the technology because there's a certain level investment in the technology. But
I mean, we could actually have a wireless system that worked?
Absolutely. Were there to be a systematic effort to, that began with the allocation of spectrum and which was rationally organized to provide wireless service to everybody who wanted it on a basis that was seamless, there is no reason that we couldn't build in the renowned five nines, as it's called, level of efficiency and service quality that characterized the old U.S. telephone system, meaning the monopoly system that AT&T dominated. Engineers called it a 5-9 system of quality because it delivered telephone service, whatever it is, 99.999% of the time with no kind of a service fault or interruption. And we, those of us who have reached an advanced age, can remember those years.
I think my daughter was used as the case study for that survey because she makes that many calls in a day so they could figure that out. Dan Schiller, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Dan is a professor here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, has a brand new book out, How to Think About Information. We're talking about it today. It was published by University of Illinois Press this year. We've covered just a smidgen of what's in this book, and I want to get to a lot of the other material because some of the most important arguments we've yet to get to. Let me just quickly talk about one issue that might seem a little wonky, but it is so important to understand not only your argument, but really the big fights in front of us, and that's what's called intellectual property or copyright. What are these policies for people who've heard the term copyright but really aren't familiar, don't know exactly what it means? What are these policies there for? What do they do? And what should we know about them?
Copyright is a kind of intellectual property, so-called, along with trademarks and patents. It's got its own legal characteristics, but it's lumped together with these other areas. And what's significant is, first of all, that the areas of the economy that are being subjected to intellectual property rules, copyright, patents, and trademarks, has been growing exponentially. It's not an accident that you are more and more aware of copyright in your daily life because you're seeing the copyright insignia on more and more stuff, or if you're not seeing it, then you're being told you're doing something that's in violation of copyright. For a lot of people in the last few years, that's centered on the exchange of music, to take one popular manifestation of the broader trend. But copyright is one of the areas in which there has been an aggressive effort by business elites around the United States and around the world to grab or claw into the area of the for-profit economy. Forms of production. And
What is copyright exactly?
Copyright's a law that says you have the right to a monopoly if you own the copyright to a particular piece or production, a book, a piece of music, some other areas, a TV show.
It's a monopoly privilege granted by the government.
It's a monopoly privilege, and what's interesting is that there's PR smog all over this. Into the 1930s and 40s, these things used to be called monopoly privileges. Now they're called intellectual property. How that was a sleight of hand was produced is an interesting question.
Yeah, I'll say.
But it's basically a way of saying we own the property that is the book you're holding or the TV show you're watching. And we get to own it for a certain period of years, life of the author plus 50 years, 75 years. There's constant efforts to make it longer because the owners are not the individual authors. The owners, in most cases, are big companies.
Now, Dan, I got to stop you there because I know your argument here, and I've read it in the book. And just as I was reading your book, I got a phone call from a friend of mine who works for the National Writers Union. And he said they want to talk to me because the writers in their union are getting they're losing so much income from illegal copying of their work that a lot of working writers, struggling writers, are basically going broke. And, you know, so if he heard what you just said, he'd say, look, Schiller, what are you talking about? This is our livelihood. And I'm sure there are some musicians around the country who get in line right behind this guy. How do you – I mean, on one hand, you have these big corporations owning these copyrights, but then it seems like at the other side, you've got a lot of, you know, low-level productive writers and musicians who depend upon copyright to make a living. Can you satisfy one group without satisfying the other, or hurt one without hurting the other?
We ought to be able to address that question front and center. Instead of saying that there's an assumed identity of interest between cultural creators and big companies, the big companies claim that they add value to the process by marketing the production, by distributing the production, and it's on that basis that they claim they should have the legal right to profit from it. It is arguable that we should have a completely different system of cultural and informational provision, in which the entity that's cut out of the picture is the big companies. We can have libraries organizing this process for all kinds of media, for not only books, as you know they're identified with, but also for music, for video, for a range of materials. And in fact, libraries are getting precisely into this through digital libraries all around the world. The question is, what limitations will they face and are they facing in doing that? And the limitation is the same one that you're drawing attention to, which is corporate capital, which says this is the high profit area of the economy. We're making it a high profit area of the economy by artificially, corralling it by copyright law, which gives us 75 years, by which time who cares about most of these kinds of products. And we take the lion's share of the profit.
You know, there's so much I want to cover, Dan Schiller, and there's a couple things we absolutely have to get to in our remaining 10 minutes or so. First of all, I want to talk about China. It's the last chapter in the book. I know you spent time there. You've been doing a lot of research on China. It is by far the fastest growing economy in the world. And you ask in the book, is China, you address the relationship of the information economy to China in the book. And then you also ask, will eventually China overtake the United States and become the dominant power in the world? Well, answer both those questions for me right now. What's the relationship of China to this whole argument about information? And what's the nature of the Chinese economy and its growth? And eventually, will it overtake the United States? What's the nature of our relationship in the coming generation?
Well, this is, as always, a very complicated question, and there are many avenues to answering it, or two questions. But the relationship to informationalized capitalism is, if China is going to re-enter or reinsert itself in the market system, it can't just do it as it likes. It has to do it in the context of the existing market system, which is centering, I'm arguing, more and more around information. So there is an information dimension to China's participation.
China just can't be a sweatshop then.
Well, from their own point of view, that's where the low profits are going to be. So from the point of view of Chinese capital, if I can say that, even though there is considerable dispute still about whether it's authentically a capitalist country, I think it is. But from the point of view of the Chinese leadership, they need to get into the high profit areas, and that's information. So they're trying to target these areas of production and exchange. Will they succeed in that? Who knows? We can't really say in any kind of certain way, but they're making an awfully good run at that effort is something we can begin to target. They have an infrastructure in place, and interestingly, an infrastructure that's been seeded by state entities rather than just, or by state-coordinated entities rather than on the same competitive free-for-all basis that's existed in the United States as they privatized telecommunications here. And they have a growing, very, very extensive broadband infrastructure for the circulation of information commodities. How they put that to use, the terms on which it develops between Chinese capital and transnational businesses, you know, the Googles and Microsofts and others of the world, remains still to be seen. But there's hard bargaining occurring about this.
How rapidly is the Chinese economy growing now, and how rapidly has it been growing over the last 10 or 15 years?
Well, it's been growing very rapidly, I think, in percentage terms between 10 and 15% each year, which rapidly moves up.
I mean, I'm not an expert at growth rates, but I know we've never had anything remotely close to that in American history, have we?
Not for a very long time. In the early years of the American Republic, possibly, or right after the Civil War, but not for a very long time. The Chinese growth rate is sufficient to vault the country into the very topmost ranks in a matter of just a short 15 or 20 years. So now you're talking about the fourth largest economy in absolute terms, and in some areas of production, it's the second largest.
How much of this growth has been based on just, you know, exploitation of labor and on one hand, and also just complete disregard for the physical environment on the other hand?
Well, you know, to ask the question is to answer it. The Chinese peasantry remains the 900 million strong exploited class of that society on which all of the rest of this growth has been predicated, which has fed tens of millions of people into the factories of Guangdong and other areas over time. The question is, to what extent will that group of working people continue to accept these absolutely unfair conditions over the period to come? So yes, and environmentally, the problems we haven't only begun to scratch the surface of the grave kinds of damage that have been done by this process of development and that are going to affect all of us around the world going forward.
So to the United States and China, what is the nature, in your view, of the relationship going to be going forward? Is this going to be the great superpower rivalry of the next 40, 50 years, or will there be a commonality of interest among the business classes in both countries that will supersede the national rivalry?
So far, what has been evident is a significant effort to try to find as much common ground as possible. Much of that up to now has been built around the need for foreign direct investment that the big businesses in the United States and, for that matter, Europe and Japan have faced. And China's being the seemingly most hospitable and potentially lucrative place in which to make those investments. So much of China's own development has been predicated on the labor of its peasantry feeding into the factories and on the capital of foreign direct investment. We've put in probably, meaning the rest of the world has put in probably $500 billion in investment there just in the last 8-10 years. That's a huge amount of money.
I'd bend over and pick it up.
Yeah, well, we all would. But the nature of the relationship will be, you know, really, I think, one of the fundamental questions, and it will feed the global geopolitics in all sorts of indirect as well as direct ways, notably, for example, over the scramble for energy resources. In order to feed this growth engine, energy resources are required. The terms of the energy acquisition are significant. There will be continual fighting and perhaps just strategizing between the elites of these countries to organize energy resources on the most favorable terms.
One of the topics that you talk about in the book that I think is really interesting and something I want to learn a lot more about is the regulation and control over the Internet, not only in the United States, but more importantly as a global entity. And I think this China-U.S. fight sort of leads into that discussion because the Internet was created for the most part in the United States, but it's truly a global medium, yet regulation of it remains in the United States. Is this going to be a problem to China and Europe and everyone else in the world that their core digital medium is controlled by a different country?
It already is a problem. And again, it's only the U.S. population that is not aware of this because we're not being given access to the kinds of debates that are swirling around in the global theater, Internet regulation and control. The fact is that a U.S. nonprofit corporation registered in California, ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, is responsible for much of the control of the Internet through its ability to determine Internet addresses and what are called generic top-level domains, meaning the .coms, .edus, and so forth. ICANN is a nonprofit corporation that has been set up and reports to the U.S. executive branch. Mm-hmm. The rest of the world is very uncomfortable with this relationship because, as you say, the Internet is an international jurisdiction. And so they are asking for and increasingly demanding that there be an internationalization of the process that's called Internet governance that would allow some greater participation by non-U.S. agencies, including governments.
Is this something like the United Nations would run? I mean, what would be the international agency that would coordinate something like
well,
this?
Well, there are different candidates for that, and there's, of course, a politics attaching to each one, and I don't have a preferred answer myself in this. I think, rather, we're at a kind of earlier stage. What we need to do is to simply determine that democracy mandates an internationalization of the governance process and that mechanisms for democratic accountability be put into that process, whatever organizational framework it's nested in.
Dan Schiller, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. We've only got about a few seconds left, Dan, actually. So what are your plans now? What are you going to turn to next?
I'm going to be working on some continuing projects on China and, on the other hand, on the Internet, and we'll see how they converge in the next year or so.
Well, I want you to come back and join us again to talk about that work, because obviously those are two of the central issues of our times and will be for the coming generation. Dan Schiller, thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters.
Thanks, Bob. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back in 167 hours with another program. Thank you very much.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
You're listening to WILL Urbana, made possible by the support of our listeners, the friends of WILL. It's 2 p.m. The Tavis Smiley Show is next.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. It's his second race for the White House, but this time he wants the leading role. Today we'll ask former North Carolina Senator John Edwards why he wants to be the President of the United States.
We have huge issues to face. We have to restore American leadership in the world. We have to address issues like global warming, a dysfunctional health care system. I believe we need universal health care. And we have got to do something to change our energy consumption and our energy economy.
Also, commentator DeRoy Murdoch explores the Republican agenda for the first 100 days. Commentator Cornel West reflects on the legacy of Dr. King. Plus, director Bill Duke and actor Dulé Hill join us to discuss interracial relationships and the revival of the play Dutchman. This hour on the Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, after the news.